Good morning, honor members, ladies and gentlemen. Honor members, we convening this morning to receive a briefing by the National Treasury on Appropriation Bill B1 2013. Which is the final step towards the adoption of the Appropriation Bill 2013-14. I have received only two apologies. One from Honorable Mpimpi. He's still on sick. Of sick as reported yesterday, and the other is from Honorable Triple M Zulu. Is attending a meeting on security and constitutional development. So those are the only apologies that we received, honorable members.
Even after you.
Then I will assume that our members who did not submit apologies are still on their way to this meeting.
Are they traveling somewhere? Are they traveling somewhere? They're on their way. Where are they going?
From their offices to this venue, I think. It's quite a long journey from this office to come here. Thank you very much. National Treasury team, you are welcome. Once again, we meet. And I think without any waste of time, I will hand over.
Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable members, honorable chair. I just want to introduce the team to you. I think most of you would know most of them, but I'm Kay Brown, and with me is Raquel Ferreira, who heads up the national budget team, and then Wendy Fano, who is from the Intergovernmental Relations Division in the Treasury. So I'll do the presentation, but in terms of taking the questions, we'll see who's most appropriate to do the answering. Should I proceed? Okay, so I think as everyone knows, the Appropriation Bill was tabled on Budget Day, and it provides for the appropriation of money from the National Revenue Fund in terms of the Constitution and in terms of the PFMA. Therefore, all spending that takes place in terms of the Appropriation Bill is subject to the PFMA, as well as any provisions in the Appropriation Act itself, when it's enacted. And for transfers to subnational government, the Division of Revenue, now the Act, also contains provisions which are binding in terms of any such spending. Parliament is essentially asked to pass the Appropriation Bill so that it can be enacted before the end of July. That is critical because until the bill is enacted, essentially we use Section 29 of the PFMA to allow spending to occur in departments and entities up to that time. However, there are certain limitations, so for the first 4 months, no more than 45% of the amount of the previous year's appropriation may be expended, and for every month after that, no more than 10% per month. Obviously, going into that period beyond July, one is concerned that in some departments that limit may actually constrain the planned activities and performance of departments. Essentially, I'm sure, as most of you know, the bill is divided into votes and by main division within a vote, in other words, programs within a vote. For each vote, you have an aim, and for each program, you have a purpose that is set out. The amounts which are indicated against any of those particular programs are categorized in terms of whether or not they are current payments, transfers and subsidies, payments for capital assets, or payments for financial assets. Very importantly, the allocations that are marked with an asterisk are earmarked as exclusively and specifically appropriated, so they may not be used for purposes other than what is indicated in that appropriation bill. All conditional grants are specifically and exclusively appropriated, and then obviously are listed and detailed in terms of the Division of Revenue Act. Essentially, the focus of the budget has been on fiscal sustainability, given the tight fiscal constraints that are being faced worldwide, but then also, obviously, on national development, on broadening government service delivery, and expanding investment in infrastructure. In order to enable that shift towards supporting socio-economic development, even more intensifying that support and broadening the service delivery base, fiscal space had to be created. And in order to do that, the provincial and national departments and entities were asked to look at their current baselines and to look at how they could reprioritize funds from within those current baselines. Essentially, there was an effort to undertake planned activities at a lower cost, which I guess is the easier bit if you can identify that and get that done, and then a little bit more hard to reduce allocations to programs that are performing below expectations and to decrease outputs in lower level priority programs. Essentially, through this process, 52 billion was cut from existing baseline allocations and reprioritized towards the priorities of government. Added to that, 37 billion was made available to compensate for general inflation costs, general baseline adjustments for current activities, and 28 billion was a drawdown on the contingency reserve. Essentially, the effect of all of this, we still see that payments for financial assets is the fastest growing area of expenditure. The payments for capital assets shows an increase in growth. Compensation of employees is encouragingly showing a reduction in growth, although obviously it's still growing. Other current payments also shows that moderation. Transfers and subsidies decline slightly in terms of its growth. And I suppose important to mention here is also that there has been a move towards greater use of indirect grants at the national level. Debt service costs are still growing and unfortunately are sort of quite stably above the 5% mark. Obviously, in terms of the rating of our country, it does affect the cost of the funds that we borrow. The key focus of the budget has been on infrastructure investment, both in terms of its potential to facilitate economic development more broadly, to provide the platform for economic growth, access to markets and so on, but also in terms of the job creation potential of infrastructure build projects. 827 billion in public sector infrastructure spending is planned for the next 3 years, and on the vote appropriation level, in other words, what you will find in your appropriation bill, we have for the year 13-14, 104 billion roughly, and you can see that over the MTEF period, what is in terms of vote appropriation is about 350 billion. You add to that the other government infrastructure investments, transfers to provinces and entities and so on, and then lastly add to that the investment planned in terms of the state-owned companies gets you over the MTEF to that amount of 827 billion. In terms of the investments in social infrastructure, this talks specifically to additions in terms of the of this last budget process. Some of these obviously funded through reprioritization. 2.4 billion for the Development Bank of South Africa to support its focus on core infrastructure funding, and of which a large component is socio-economic development. 160 million, nearly 700 million over the MTEF, to the Social Housing Regulatory Authority for medium density rental housing. 200 million in this financial year for the Magalies Water Project for bulk water provision. 312 million, nearly 2 billion over the MTEF, for the Municipal Water Infrastructure Grant for the treatment of water, its distribution, demand management, and other support in rural municipalities. 171 million, 1.5 billion over the MTEF, for the De Wyp Dam bulk distribution system. And then 150 million in this year to manage the acid mine water drainage problems that we have. Also, as an addition in this particular budget, 2.6 billion in this financial year, nearly 11 billion over the MTEF for the improved conditions of service in for employees in the public sector. But broadly speaking, one should focus not only on additions in a particular budget, but on all the money in the baseline. So the total appropriation bill amounts to 589 billion. Of that, a fifth of that goes to social development as a department, actually a little bit more than a fifth, 20.5%, and it includes social assistance grants to the value of 113 billion, which is 19.2% of the total vote appropriation. So that's a really big program on our budget. Police accounts for about, well, let's say 11.5 as opposed to calling it 12% of the total appropriation, including the visible policing program, which is at the value of 31.5 billion. Cooperative governments and traditional affairs, nearly 10% of the vote appropriation goes to that department, and it includes local government equitable share transfer of 41 billion. Essentially that then obviously supplemented by own revenue also in municipalities. Transport, 7.2% of the total bill appropriation. It includes the road transport program to the value of nearly 20 billion. And then there were some important additions in this financial year, in this budget, 275 million to SANRAL for road upgrades and 250 million to PRASA for the rolling stock and signaling infrastructure. Defence and military veterans, I know they always have the figure of the 2% of the GDP as sort of their aim, but defence and military veterans, nearly 7% of the total vote appropriation bill, and includes the Landward Defence Program, that single program is nearly 14 billion or 2.4% of the total bill appropriation. Higher education and training, 5.8% of the total bill appropriation, and includes higher education institution transfers of about 22 billion. That also includes specifically additions in this past budget of 1.7 billion over the MTEF for the two new universities in Mpumalanga and the Northern Cape. Health, which comprises about 5.2% of the total bill appropriation, includes the hospitals, tertiary health services, and human resource development program, which is about 18 billion. Science and technology, 1.1% of the total bill appropriation, does have some important additions in this particular budget. 1.1 billion over the MTEF for the design and pre-construction phase of the SKA, and about 600 million over the MTEF for additions to the National Research Foundation for the modernization of laboratories and equipment. Communication, 0.3% of the total bill appropriation, but has an addition of 277 million in this financial year to CENTEC for the rollout of the infrastructure of digital terrestrial television. Think that basically highlights some of the important information within the bill. As I'm sure members do know, if you want lots of information about what's contained in the bill, you can look at the E&E publication, which is the object to the bill and does provide lots of detail in terms of each of the allocations. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Doctor. Honourable members, that's the story. Any questions for clarity? Honourable Mashile, Honourable Liz, and Honourable Joseph, in that order.
Thanks, Jefferson. I just wanted to check on the social infrastructure. All items that are there, and then we have got figures, additional figures over the MTEF. But the last one that talks to the acid mine water drainage, then 150 million for the 2013-14. Is this only a single financial year allocation plan? Thanks, sir.
Madam Liz.
Chairman, thank you. Just on, to clarify, on in terms of the SANRAL, the 275 million and 1.4 billion over the MTEF, those additional allocations, are they for construction still to take place, or are they to cover roads that have already been constructed and need to be paid for, or loans paid for? A question that kind of has been hanging around the committee for a while, and we get answers, but we don't get answers. Let's go back to the kind of principle here. When this becomes an act, then spending has to either fall within the budget or there has to be an adjustments budget. When this budget is, when the provinces do similar budgets, they also have to spend within that budget. When they are, the Free State, for instance, has this grant that they're subsidizing municipalities with. In other words, what they're doing, they're skewing the equitable share, and they're taking money from provincial equitable share and pushing it into municipalities. How legal is that? I mean, we get differing answers, but my view is it's clearly illegal. There are no adjustment budgets. Grants are not specified when the budget is done what that grant is for. It's kind of like a slush fund. And it then obviously makes it possible for municipalities to be bankrupt but just carry on because they know they've got this buffer sitting there that the province is going to push down. Just your views on that. The contingency reserve, I mean, we were very concerned about the use of the contingency reserve to make the budget balance to the point it has balanced. We know it's it doesn't balance, but the deficit is less because we've used the contingency reserve. Historically, has the contingency reserve been a kind of surplus that we've never touched? What are the chances that we, in terms of the history of that fund, that we're going to need it?
you know, it's possible, but how probable is it, is basically what I'm saying. And I don't, you can't forecast what the good Lord's going to do with weather and all sorts of other things, but just historically, have we over provided for that contingency? I think that's it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Honourable Chairman.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm covered by the previous question. I just want to go on to the focus of the budget, of the 2013 budget that I'm heading. I just want to know if I see the budget focus on the national development and fiscal sustainability. I want to know if the national development plan is also part of the focus. Otherwise, I thought it would have been good to see national development plan and fiscal, you know, creating fiscal stability. Then the 52.1 billion, which you refer to as for government priorities, I think that's the word you phrased. I'd like to know what is the government priorities, other than what you further explain, if it's different to what is further in the document. And then the compensation of employees. I'm not sure that how can decline unless you only refer to the amount of employees but not the amount that we pay out to employees, because to my opinion government, the cost of employment is growing, it's always increasing, and in some municipalities alarming if it goes to 50%, because the point that's been raised earlier on the second paragraph under focus of the budget is to broaden service delivery, and the concern is that the more money we spend on cost of employees, the less money there is for service delivery. So it's a balance there. On the previous member's question on the mine water drainage, I want to ask, my question was going to be, what is that amount in relation to the previous year, or is it a new addition to the budget? Or is there an increase to the previous year? Otherwise, is government paying attention to that, or is it something new? Because I remember when we went to Mpumalanga, the last taking parliament of the people, there was an outcry from the people about how the mines contaminate the water, and the commitment that was given that it would be investigated. So. Thank you, that's what I've for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. On the question of compensation of employees, Doctor, I just want to understand as to, because at some point this was posing some serious challenges as it was growing fast. Now there's a decline. What could be the reason of that decline, and how sustainable those reasons are going forward? Mm-hmm. And if you could clarify, what would be the acceptable standard or level of under expenditure by department and provincial government, because others will say, you know, the acceptable standard is 2%, and others are saying it's 5%. One is not sure what is the acceptable one, what is this, if there is a set standard of under expenditure on the overall budget of each and every department or province. Honourable GP.
I've got a question, Mike. Chairperson, coming back to the issue of the compensation of employees, we are now going through an exercise of the intervention in Limpopo, where headcount has been done in education and in health, and when the Division of Revenue Bill was dealt with at the beginning of the year, we made a proposal to the minister that in each province such an head count be done, because what came out in Limpopo is very interesting in terms of the excess of personnel. It's costing us, it's costing the country, it's costing the taxpayer. So to take that route, to see how we can minimize bring down the wage bill. Thank you.
I'm going to try my best. I'm going to just give Wendy some prior warning that I'm going to let her answer the question with regard to that municipal grant. And I'm obviously also going to let her come in on some of the others if she needs to, possibly even the one on the headcount. In terms of the money for the acid mine drainage, it is the additional money, and it is only for this financial year. In terms of the mining and the problems that the rehabilitation of mines are basically causing us, clearly there's a lot of rehabilitation that needs to take place to prevent even further damage of our water systems and so on. This money that we're referring to is the money that needs to be spent sort of in the Gauteng area where the water deterioration is absolutely critical. And if we're to avoid diseases and other issues related to the use of this bad water, we need to sort it out. In terms of that, we had in the adjustments budget last year given money in terms of the unforeseeable and unavoidable criterion. I can't remember exactly. It was about 200 million, of which 24.5 million was spent. This is then another allocation, and the idea is that this is sort of the emergency response to that particular problem. But yes, we do need to address the problem more broadly. We do not want to wait until we get to that level of contamination, because I think the cleanup and so on is also more expensive. My understanding is that the Department of Minerals is obviously well aware of this problem and has a plan. If my memory serves me correctly, I think there's something like 150 mines that need to be rehabilitated, and obviously they list those in terms of the level of priority, but they are getting that attention. With regards to the SANRAL additions, that is in respect of expenditure that is still to be incurred for the increase in the rolling stock as part of the railroad build program that we've embarked upon in the last year's budget, and obviously the signalling requirements in relation to that. That's also why you'll see that the amount is bigger over the MTEF period. In terms of the contingency reserve, what we have historically done is we've always called it a contingency reserve, but it has been a contingency reserve, strictly speaking, as well as a bit of a policy reserve. Essentially what we've lost now is the policy reserve part of it. So how it would work would be that it was normally 6/12/24. If you go back in previous budgets, you'll see that sort of was always we drew down and we'd always keep it at that level. So essentially when we would look at the new macroeconomic forecast, excuse me, and then we would look at what the revenue was expected and so on, one would look at what the fiscal position was, and then one would allow some sort of policy drawdown in the new first year of a new MTEF, which would be the second year and the third year, and then create a new third year. But essentially now we've used that portion of it, so what's there now is literally for unforeseen and other contingency events. So in a sense that means that the budgeting is going to be much, much harder than before. And I guess it really calls on us to exercise extreme scrutiny over the performance of departments, because now we are in a position where when funds are being used by one department, there is an opportunity cost in terms of another department that could be using the funding. So I think that's where we are, but I think we've got enough in the contingency reserve to cover contingencies proper. It's just that we don't have any policy buffers. In terms of the question that Honourable Josephs posed around the national development, that was just a turn of phrase there. It wasn't a direct reference to the National Development Plan, which at the stage that we were preparing the last budget was still in draft form. And in fact, to the extent that some of the actions and activities in the National Development Plan are current activities of departments, yes, those are included and are on budget, but to the extent that there are new and different things that departments need to do, those, I think, in response to the final draft now of the National Development Plan, departments are still planning, and we are anticipating that it would start coming into this particular budget round, and probably in next year's budget even more strongly so. In terms of the actual priorities, I do realize that I should probably have been a little bit more specific in the presentation. So essentially it was infrastructure investment as one, employment, local government support, and economic support, as in terms of the comprehensive support package. So those were the four, I would call them, sort of main themes or areas of focus in the last budget. And in terms of the composition, compensation of employees, I just want to go, essentially it's not that compensation of our employees, the amount is decreasing, it is the growth in that. So, in other words, it was a certain amount before, it grew by 7% on average per annum, and now basically it grew only by 1.8%, which means that to some extent we've got a handle and have contained the growth. That has been done using a number of initiatives. Honourable Zabir mentioned the headcount initiative. Wendy may want to add when she comes in as well, but in terms of that headcount initiative, Statistics South Africa is assisting and undertaking that, and essentially it's being conducted in all of the provinces, I think. And the first results for the first two, I just can't remember which provinces, are expected in July. So that is something that certainly will be looked at. But in terms of containing the compensation of employees expenditure in general, it is about looking particularly at vacant posts and asking departments within their reprioritization exercises to really look at whether or not they need to fill posts, and if they don't need to fill those posts, if they've been vacant for a number of years and there really aren't any hard plans for that or any compelling needs in terms of performance, to actually move that money out of that budget and into the core service delivery areas where we want that. I think departments have also started looking at their personnel profile. Do you replace a chief director with two deputy directors, depending on what the particular job is? That might be a good decision. So I think there's a lot more thought going into the compensation of employees, personnel profiles within departments and so on. a reprioritization even within compensation of employees, and certainly a concerted effort to control the growth in headcount numbers. The concerted effort then is to contain such growth to the extent that it can be justified in terms of the performance, in terms of the vote programs. So it's not to say there will be no headcount growth, it's just that where there is that headcount growth, that needs to be justified in terms of the performance of departments, and not just justified by the fact that in terms of our DPSA approved organogram, you know, we have X amount of vacancies. That obviously is also something that we're doing out of necessity given the fiscal environment we find ourselves in. Then, Honourable Chair, in terms of the under expenditure and what's an acceptable level of underspending, I'm not so sure if one can talk about an acceptable level of underspending. I know of only one example where one might say that underspending is acceptable, unequivocally so, and that would be the disaster response grants in the Department of Cooperative Governance, because those grants are only meant to be spent if there is a disaster, and one that qualifies in terms of the fact that it has been declared and in terms of the fact that the municipalities and provinces are not able to fund the financial impact thereof. If there is no such disaster, then that funding should not be spent, and it's acceptable that there is underspending there. In terms of other underspending, I think one has to look at the underspending and the reason for that particular underspending. I'm loath to make the opposite statement, which is that all underspending is completely unacceptable, because if plans do not, or if events do not support good planning or mediocre or whatever, if your plans don't turn out as you would like, I'm loath to want to say you must spend at all costs, which would just amount to fiscal dumping. So I'm sounding like an economist. On the one hand, I don't want to say that underspending is acceptable, but on the other hand, I don't really want to say that all underspending is unacceptable either. So I think, you know, a judgment around what the performance is relative to the spending, I think that would be what I would prefer focus on, rather than just the level of underspending only or overspending in isolation. I think I'll stop there and give Wendy a chance to come in, and I don't know if Raquel would like to add as well.
Thank you. With regard to the question about, or just to add maybe also to the ICS and the growth in that, what was also important is that in the past a uniform growth rate was catered for, and where there's now been a change is that in terms of core staff, i.e. staff where it's really needed, such as health professionals, educators and the like, where there's shortages, a bigger growth rate was provided for than, for example, administrative staff, where in certain cases you can actually argue that there's a surplus. So those are some of the changes that were made to actually ensure that there's staff appointed where they really, really need it. Then with regard to the headcount, yes, it will definitely be replicated in other provinces, and with a key focus on education and health. So there's various initiatives underway. The SAT-S is but one. There's various others. But just maybe to add to that as well, another key department where personnel numbers are quite big, if you want to get value for your money, you need to focus where they're really the big staff are, and that's in the defence sector as well, defence, police and the like. So that sector will most probably be subjected to a personnel review as well. So just for information. Then with regard to grants to municipalities, very nice question. Firstly, if you look at the Division of Revenue Act 2013, it's last week the President signed, so it's very nice to say it's now an act. There's various provisions in the Division of Revenue Act that actually deals with this issue, and I'll just quickly quote some of them. It says, Section 28.7, it says the municipality must ensure that any allocation made in terms of the Division of Revenue Act or by a province or another municipality, it must be reflected in the municipal budget. And then the same applies with regard to the provincial treasury, section 29.2. It says the provincial treasury must, on the same day that its budget is tabled in the provincial legislature, which is 14 days after the national budget is tabled, must actually in a gazette then indicate all the allocations that it's making available for municipalities. And then it also indicates that it may be changed and it's then subject to certain processes to be re-gazetted again. But having said that, keep in mind that there's various types of transfers that you get to municipalities. For example, there's specific functions, that's provincial functions, such as library services, where the municipality actually does the service on behalf of the province. So that is what we call an agency service, so that will be gazetted. Then provinces has also got specific responsibilities to build the capacity of municipalities. So they are allowed to make transfers in that regard as well. And then there's other type of transfers where, for example, there's interlinkages between a project that a province is rolling out together with that of municipality. For example, if you build a school, you need to ensure that there's roads and the like that's aligned to that. So there's various types of transfers that are actually taking place. The issue about bailouts and where a municipality flagrantly breaks certain financial management rules and a transfer is then made, that is, you could most probably struggle to say it's illegal, but it's definitely not in the spirit of any legislation, because if you look at both the PFMA as well as the MFMA, it makes it very clear that there's no bailout. A sphere must take accountability, or a municipality must take into account their responsibilities. So you can't just look at the Division of Revenue Act. You must read it together also with the Municipal Finance Management Act, which actually then stipulates that certain types of behaviours are then seen as irregular and illegal, and it does actually then indicate when it's an offence. So, and also when it's financial misconduct. So those clauses, you can't use it in an allocation to circumvent those provisions in the MFMA. So it's very important that we read those together as well. Hope that assists.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Follow-ups, Honorable Joseph, Liz, and Mashila.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to clarify if there is a benchmark percentage prescribed in terms of cost of employees. That's why I earlier raised the point that some municipalities go even up to 50%, while some maybe believe 33% to 40%. Is there a national guidance or benchmark to guide municipalities to make sure that more money is spent on service delivery and not on the employees, although they are there to deliver that service, but just to get that balance right. And then the other point about the transfer of money from national or province to province or from province to local government at the very late stage of the year is almost like dumping the money there, cleaning their books. They've, you know, they've spent all that money, but the money's just been transferred to once off, and then it doesn't give the municipality or the province that time to spend that money within the, in that financial year, which then reflects badly on that municipality. So just wanted to know if there's guidance there, because I think you said in your second page earlier, you said about not after July, not 10% monthly. So I want to know if that relates to, if that is the guidance on that, and why the other activity then happens. Thank you.
Liz.
Ms. Chin, thank you, Wendy, for that. I'm talking about this bailout thing. You know, the transfers and concurrent functions and joint projects, one understands all that. But where these bailouts have occurred, and they have occurred in the Free State quite extensively, what are the consequences? Whose job is it to highlight this, and what happens? Is it simply the Auditor General making a qualified audit and that's the end of it? Or is there more to it? I'm aware that National Treasury wrote to the Provincial Treasury in late in 2011 about this matter. But I'm not aware of any change. So is National Treasury absolutely powerless in this aspect? Then I wonder if you could help me. It's a new question. I'm sorry, I hadn't picked it up earlier. This huge transfer to DBSA, 2.4 billion, 7.9 billion over the MTF. You've made some general comments there about what it's for, but it's a huge amount of money. Is the DBSA bankrupt? Or why? On what basis has the additional money been transferred to the DBSA? In other words, do they have particular plans to do X, Y, Z with it, or is it just here's some money, spend it on growing assets, loan disbursements, which is their business anyway. So we're just recapitalizing them, and then they carry on with their normal business. I'm battling with that. We're just going to dump the 2.4, and then perhaps they don't need it. What are they actually going to do with it? You mentioned briefly when you were talking about the contingency reserve, the revenue forecast. Are you involved at all in that ongoing process of forecasting revenue? Because I gather that the latest forecast is somewhat dismal. Would you be able to give us any information about that and what impact it might have on this particular bill or on this budget? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think I've got two questions that I will apologize if maybe there was clarification that was made
before I arrived, Chair. And if there was clarification on them, I think there will be no need to explain to me, and then my friends will make my life a lot more easier after this meeting. One, I just wanted to know from the Treasury, the MFMA, PFMA, the preferential procurement policy, the ones that we are actually managing or using now, over the past 12 months, is there anything that Treasury has picked up that they think it needs to be relooked in the provisions of those specific pieces of legislation that govern the use of our public resources? Then on the funds that are being made available for the 2013, I'm seeing one is the 52.1 billion, which it is claimed to be expenditure reductions. It explains the source where it comes from. And then there is 37.2 billion, which is made to compensate mainly for general inflation. Where does it come from? And then the 27.9 billion, it is claimed to be a drawdown from the contingency reserve. What is the level of our contingency reserve after this particular drawdown? Is it adequate, or are we taking chances? And then, Chair, the other one is Of course, a follow-up to the one on the acceptable under-expenditure. Unfortunately, Chair, only last night I was listening to some mayor of a municipality in the Eastern Cape who said that it is acceptable to underspend by 5%. And he claimed his municipality to be having spent at 2%, which he was claiming to be a victory, something to really boast about. I heard it only last night. Then now, what I've heard across is that no under-expenditure that is acceptable, even though it's towards the end of that explanation, she tried to be diplomatic about it. But this one mayor yesterday said 5% allowed under-expenditure 5%, and wanted to boast about having underspent by 2%, which looks to be a great achievement to him. Probably then maybe you can understand whether there are different standards in the national, province, and municipalities, or the comments he was making was across all government. Then there is one thing, Chair, which we have been making noise, I think. I'm not sure whether it filters back to the powers that be in Treasury. A municipality that underspends, then the money goes back to Treasury, say in the form of the conditional grants, and then that municipality gets less allocation the following financial year. Then the amounts are directed to other municipalities or other government entities. I think we've been making noise about this, that while the intention is to actually punish the unexpenditure, but we are actually punishing the people that must receive the services, who have got no say in the people that are employed in the municipality, who actually result in these under-expenditures because of lack of skills. We at the end of the day, we end up punishing the people, actually agitating protests. Now, I just want to understand now from Treasury whether, because some of these things, of course, we speak with Wendy and Sishi. Now, the question is whether these things filters up. What is the response to that? Because we are politicians. We are not in the business of actually punishing officials or whatever. We are in the business of getting services to people. And the budget is a tool to do that. And when that does not happen, then people are not getting services. What is the response from a Treasury? Then the other one is the issue that we have been making noise about Western Cape and Gauteng, where they don't reflect under expenditure because they just dump money into agencies or implementing agents and reflect total expenditure and qualify for a full allocation, whereas they may be worse than other provinces or other metros who actually report honestly for what they've done, and when there is an under-expenditure, then they reflect that it's under-expenditure. Then the other one then doesn't reflect under-expenditure because they've actually just thrown the money. We don't know whether it has been spent properly or not. And then, but they get full allocation, the other one don't get full allocation. What is the response of Treasury on that specific one? I think those are the issues, Chair, that I just wanted to raise. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Members. Thanks, Dr. Brown. I think on this thing of under-expenditure, not only that municipality, I had the Minister of Human Settlement yesterday in the House also saying, well, the acceptable level is 5%, and I'm within 5%, I've done great and all those things. Not only him, the MEC of Finance in Western Cape, 2 weeks ago, he was saying they have done their best because the overall underexpenditure of the province is 2%. In Gauteng, the DA was up in arms because there was 2.something billion underexpenditure, and Gauteng was saying, no, it's within the acceptable norms and standards. And Northwest, 1.3 billion, and Limpopo, 2.1 billion. And, I mean, it has always been our understanding that no department of government should underspend, because funding is based on the plans submitted and approved. But it's quite surprising this year. There's a turn of events. Everybody wants to celebrate this under-expenditure. And that's why we are asking this question, because we are worried about it. We are very much worried about it. It's happening from national departments down to local municipalities. Now, and what is even worse, Doctor, which is something that would want you to take up with National Treasury during some of these processes, is this tendency now, which is becoming a trend, where at this time of the year we come here, debate budget, votes, agree on this division of revenue, appropriation bills, allocate funds because the plans are said to be credible and all those things. And then the next thing, 10 months down the line, you are told that people who are non-performing, all of a sudden you'll be told that the results of that non-performance are savings and reprioritization and all those things. I mean, we really don't understand that. And I'm saying it's becoming a habit, because every year you'll hear National Treasury also patting them on the shoulder that we have saved so much, we have saved so much from projects that were not able to take off. We have saved so much from this and this and this. But closely looking at that, one, it encourages people now not to perform to their best ability, because whatever that they don't spend, it will now be taken as a saving, something that the National Treasury will pat you on the shoulder for, and the minister will also, even in his budget speech, make mention of it. And it will be applauded by those listening. Yeah, it's a saving. Wow. But we are not happy as a committee, I must say. We have been observing this thing from the beginning of the year, and it happened last year, it's happening again this year. This year now is coupled by those who are saying, no, the under expenditure, 2%, acceptable. Don't worry, we are doing better, as long as we are not far beyond 5%. Those are the worrying factors. It's something that, if we have time, we would want to engage further on it. But because of lack of time, I'm just putting it on the table that much as you'd try your best to respond to it, but it's something that we would want you to take further with the minister and them. And time permitting, it's a matter that we would also want to raise directly with them. With the minister, because quite frankly, some of the savings are questionable. And now that even people are getting proud of underspending, it's even beginning to be more worrying than before. Honorable members, the National Treasurer will be responding any other thing that you might have omitted when you raised your issues. Honorable Makubele, do you have anything? Nothing.
No. You know why I'm laughing? During the Pakistan, when you had that saving, they used to pay that secretary as a good money.
Bonus.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
You know? Sometimes it's happening.
I know the private sector to be the only sector that wants such savings.
Chair,
I think there is also one real serious issue. I'm not sure whether it may be above the delegation that we have now here. I'm not sure, Chair. The issue that year in, year out, we get municipalities that walks freely into Section 139 in front of National Treasury, assisted by Provincial Treasury. These municipalities walk into Section 139, and one of the reasons is that they are almost bankrupt. They can't pay for what. Now, one really asks these serious questions that I'm sure we have asked Wendy many times as well. She has been in front of all the fires. We don't know whether she has got plans to put down the fires. Chair, because really these municipalities, if we are properly receiving their reports in terms of their finances and annual financial statements, I'm sure now they almost produce this monthly, if not quarterly, annual financial statements. And then I just want to know, but how do these municipalities really walk freely into Section 139? When we have got Chapter 3, I think that talks about the intergovernmental relations and all sorts of things. And I just wanted really to know whether Treasury just wait until, it may be national or provincial treasury, let me not discriminate, because almost all of us, we are doing the same thing, and you know, it's monitoring all the departments around us, entities around us that are reporting to us. How is this possible, that the municipality can walk into Section 139 on the basis of finances, or lack of finances, or abuse of finances? I'm just requesting that, Chair, and of course is that it does happen with other provinces. You'll remember Eastern Cape also, when it was taken to Section 100 or whatever, it was the same thing, and then it was now of late we are dealing with the Limpopo issue, being on the basis of finances. And when you speak to Limpopo, they'll tell you that the problem of their finances started long before. But then when you get the report from Treasury, they tell you about the year before they were taken to Section 100, that the actions that National Treasury tries to take with the province, they were not started when that problem started in Limpopo. Now the question is, how does this happen with the kind of reporting mechanisms and the kind of powers that national has, province has, and over these other departments and other entities of government? Thanks, sir.
Thank you, honourable members. Dr. Brown and your team, I'm sure you'll share some of these questions. But I think we've, just my comment on the last point raised by Honourable Mashile, because you see, in my view, the issues relating to local government are more political than administrative. Because in most instances, that I know, let me take my province, where I know almost all municipalities at some point, almost all of them went through the process of Section 139. But you'll find that the National Treasury was quite aware of such an eventuality, and issues were raised with the leadership of these municipalities and the province, but nothing happened until the late stage of now having to place municipalities under Section 139. Now, I'm not sure whether it's because the National Treasury is more softer than the Auditor General. The Auditor General comes at the end of everything, but he's not afraid to point the real reasons. If it's leadership, he'll say the problem here is leadership. If it's capacity, he'll say it's capacity. If it's this, he always mentioned three things: leadership, capacity, and this own flawed process of supply chain. Mm-hmm. Now, but the National Treasury, why I'm saying maybe it's because you are too soft. There are warning signals, like for an example, in my constituency, I requested the National Treasury to do analysis on their financial situation and its sustainability, because I was convinced that they are heading for a crisis. And indeed, the result thereof was that, hey, these people, anytime soon, they might not even be able to pay salaries. But then when I follow up with the officials of the National Treasury and Provincial Treasury, they have been quite aware of the situation from their offices because they received this report. But they couldn't make noise about it or speak hard on those particular facts. Until now, that stage when I intervened and I had to push for the Art Municipality to be put under Section 139. It is under 139 now, to much resistance of the province, but it is. So, perhaps the manner in which we are raising these things as National Treasury, we are too much trying to be soft to satisfy the feelings of those in the driving seats, and it's not helping us. Well, that is the perception I have, or my own view. I might be wrong, but I was just preparing you to respond, Dr. Brown, so you can respond.
Or before she responds, can I tie up with your comment?
Yes.
And at the same time, you find that. Yeah, sorry.
And at the same time, you find that the rollover money is there, and at the same time, they allocate another money. When are you going to break that chain? Because you have another money here, they've asked the rollover, and it's not spent.
Questions for clarity session is now closed.
Thank you.
Dr. Brown.
Honorable Chair and members, I'm going to stop short of saying thank you. I'm not so sure. Just for Wendy, I'm going to let you talk to the question around the benchmark sort of ratio of COE spending. The question around the highlighting the bailouts of municipalities and who's meant to be detecting that. Questions around walking easily into 139 and Treasury being soft. I noticed that with intrigue. I seem to recall that at one point people wanted to clip the wings of the Treasury, and now I'm hearing that we're soft. So I suppose in different economic circumstances, maybe we're supposed to be different, or maybe we should be even harder. I'm not sure. But and then also the question on the withholding of grants that are underspending, which was raised by the Honourable Mashile. Interestingly enough, I'm going to let Wendy answer that one, but I would say that actually it's not us by withholding that are punishing the people, because as far as I know, we never withhold funds that can properly be spent. So in fact, the people that are punishing the citizens who should, rightly so, you're correct, receive the services, are those people that are responsible for the execution and operation of those activities in respect of that grant that actually are not undertaking their activities and doing their job, which they're being paid for. But I'm sure Wendy will elaborate on that. But my understanding is that we only withhold funds when they cannot be spent in terms of the conditions that they should be, and when clearly the underspending is of such a nature that there's never, you know, with whatever time is left in the financial year, there's never going to be expenditure of that funding. And I think, I believe we do that in order to give, maybe that's where we're being a bit hard, but we do that in order to wake up those officials into doing what they should be doing. But Wendy, now I think I'm answering the question and maybe I shouldn't be. Let me get to the other questions. Honourable Joseph, in terms of the section 29 and those percentages that we gave, this is in terms of when, before we have the bill enacted, then we use this section, which allows us to spend essentially against last year's appropriation bill. So the only point that's being made here is that if you get beyond July and into August, then the spending is capped to 10%, and it might mean that for some departments that is out, that doesn't, that's not enough for their planned expenditure, as they normally indicate to us every year, every month, what their drawings will be in line with their plans. So that's not meant to be at all a benchmark in relation to compensation of employees or anything. But you can see in terms of Section 29 that if we went into month 11 of the financial year and had not got an appropriation bill enacted, you know, we would be in serious trouble. We would have gone beyond the 100%, if I can put it that way, because it's 45% in the first 4 months, 10% in the following months. We would be in trouble. Okay. In terms of the benchmarks on compensation of employees, which was your question, I think it varies from sector to sector. In some cases, I think there are norms and standards which would imply a certain sort of personnel profile and personnel numbers. Thinking, for example, if we say in a particular hospital, I know Health is working on norms and standards at the moment, we want the ratio of nurses to doctors to be the following and so on and so forth, then you would have, I think, certain norms, and then relate that, say, for example, to the goods and services that must go with that, like medicine and so on. You probably would be able to get a sort of benchmark range of compensation of employees, for example, in health. And it does vary from sector to sector. Wendy had already mentioned that policing and defence, for example, as national and not concurrent functions, are very labour intensive, whereas we don't expect some of the other national departments to be that labour intensive. So it does vary from sector to sector. I think both sectors have a sense of what the benchmark should be, and those, some of them have them in terms of norms and standards, others have them in terms of the international comparisons and some of the work that they do in their finance sections. But Wendy can talk more specifically, I think, to municipalities. Wendy had already mentioned that the one thing that we are being very vigilant on is the ballooning of administrative staff vis-a-vis core service delivery line staff. Then the question around the transfers to entities or to another sphere at a very late stage in the financial year, which amounts to dumping to those entities or spheres. Honourable Mashile also mentioned the Western Cape and Gauteng in terms of making sure that funding is transferred and therefore having a 100% spending rate. I think that's also something that we are being vigilant about, and we do understand that there's a difference between having transferred the funding and whether or not that funding was actually spent when it reached that sphere or that entity. And I think a key thing which we are focusing on and which I think we want to sharpen is whether that spending was planned for that particular time in the financial year. Because it can be so that a particular thing will be delivered in the last quarter, and therefore that's why the funding will be transferred then, and the service will be delivered and the money will be expensed. But in the case where it's unplanned, then obviously it is raising flags, I think, as a general statement. But again, Wendy might want to come in on some of the specific examples you've used. In terms of the Development Bank of South Africa, I haven't got all the details with me. I certainly am not aware that they may be bankrupt. I hope they're not. But I think in terms of the budget process, certainly if the funding was allocated through the Minister's Committee and so on, then the funding is needed. I don't think it's a matter of saying they've got billions in surplus and then we decided to add to it. It's money that is needed, and the money actually is going to be spent in four areas, and I'd ask Raquel just to phone through and get what those areas specifically are so she can give you that information. I'll just hand over quickly if you don't mind.
So basically the money is for the recapitalization of the bank to support its refocused mandate on core infrastructure funding by increasing its lending to municipalities, state-owned companies, and regional lending and private-public partnership. The rebuilding of the bank's capital base will allow it to increase its assets to $91 billion by 2017 and enable loan disbursements of between $8 billion to $21 billion per year. If we look at each sector, to municipalities, over the three-year period, the target is to lend them $12.4 billion, as well as 5% of the DBSA's operating income on non-lending support. To the state-owned companies, it's $8 billion. To other in other public areas, like for your independent power producers, that's about $6.5 billion. To the private sector, $1.8 billion, and outside of South Africa, within Africa, that's $10.5 billion, and that's basically to focus on energy, transport, water, and ICT. The total for the target going forward for the 3 years is $41.4 billion.
All right. In terms of the question around the revenue forecasts and whether we can say anything, I'm not directly involved in that section. We focus more on the spending and the spending forecasting. But obviously, we are, you know, working hand in hand with the people that are forecasting the revenue. I'm sure members would know that due to the downward revision of the GDP forecasts because of what is happening internationally and also what is happening within the domestic South African economy, obviously that has had an impact on the revenue forecasts, and those forecasts are basically being run almost on a weekly basis with the updated information. I think also adding to our spending woes is the fact then that is the cost of the debt, and so the potential of a downgrade I think is also sort of a big thing in terms of looking at spending and the spending levels and whether we can sustain the spending level, and I think that's where the question was coming from. So we are looking at those revenue forecasts. We are looking at scenarios almost, as I say, almost on a weekly basis. We're looking at scenarios in terms of the cost of our debt and what the interest rate will be that we'll have to pay, or the interest cost will be when we raise debt. And we are looking at what that means, again, with scenarios in terms of spending. Honourable members will remember that in terms of this budget, we've said that there's an expenditure ceiling. We will not breach the expenditure ceiling. And I think what we're looking at now is the appropriate level of that ceiling. So I think it's too early to specifically say, you know, what it is we will need to do, but please be rest assured that we are looking at what all of this will mean at the end of the day. Particularly important, obviously, that we do manage that, because we have had the experience in our recent past of the service costs of debts increasing greatly relative to what they were, say, 5 years ago. And if we don't manage that, then obviously it just means there's less money for government service delivery. Honourable Mashile, in terms of the different acts, whether or not we think there might be time for some changes, in terms of that, what I can talk to, and there might be other things if people know this from the Treasury, they should say so, but I am aware that we were looking at and are still looking at the Treasury regulations which support the PFMA, and looking then at changing some of the procedures, maybe some tightening as opposed to softening of some of the procedures around various elements of budgeting, and particularly the procurement aspects have been sort of prioritized as the first to conclude and so on. So I think that is where we are. We are looking at whether or not the way in which we realize the spirit and the content of those acts may need to change in light of the different fiscal circumstances that we find ourselves in. And also given that, you know, some time has elapsed, so it's quite clear where some of what we had put down as practice might not quite be sharp enough. In terms of the contingency reserve, are we taking chances? I sincerely hope we're not taking chances. No, we're not taking chances. We will be able to fund real and proper contingencies, but we have lost the luxury of having policy space in what we used to call our contingency reserve. And I've already explained that we are looking at different scenarios constantly. I think if we thought that we were going into a really, really uncertain period and we were battling to kind of pick conclusively one of the scenarios in preparation of the next budget, I think then if we then thought that because of that we needed to add a buffer back into the contingency reserve, we would do that. So I think for where we are, and certainly for where we were in terms of preparation of this budget, we definitely were not taking chances. Okay, in terms of what level of underspending is acceptable. Firstly, a confession. I come from the Eastern Cape, so we just put that out there before. I'm not aware of any percentage for underspending that we said is acceptable. Whether I'm talking about provincial treasuries or national treasuries, I'm not aware that anyone has said, you know, 5%. Is acceptable. I know that we have a percentage out there for violence, which is 8%, which I'm almost scared to raise because I don't think we want to go into that debate here and today again, because obviously there are different views about whether that's the correct percentage and so on, and correctly so, we should have those conversations. Perhaps in terms of of that municipality. I don't know what the spending underspending history may have been. Maybe, you know, 2% looks good relative to it used to be 10%. Maybe someone is making the comment in that regard. I think linked to that, the Honourable Chair raised the issue of savings and celebrating savings and applauding and so on. I think you know the dilemma for the Treasury here is that when we have to provide money on budget, and when you have to approve it coming through Parliament, you and we are aware of the fact that we are paying interest costs on that money. We, in every financial year in the most recent past, have not raised enough revenue to actually pay for what we spend. We are increasing our borrowings every year. On that, we are paying interest, and as we would get downgraded, the interest cost increases. So to put money to someone's budget costs. So we do not want money to put money to budget for which there are not concrete plans. We are also not happy when we discover that money has been put to a budget and departments somehow now do not have the plans that they ostensibly had, or they decided they don't want to use those plans, they've got another plan, or whatever the case may be. However, it would be foolhardy for us, once we become aware of that due to our monitoring, to continue to leave the money there. Then we must rather move the money, either pull the money back into the National Revenue Fund, or give it to another department that can actually deliver services, because we're paying an interest cost on the money, and the money should be able to give us something. So I'm not so sure. I mean, yes, people do applaud, and we obviously are happy that our monitoring allows us to be able to identify where money is not being optimally used, but we're not happy that money is not used as was the original intention or the original plan. And I guess the Honourable Mashile also raised the issue in a sense when he spoke about the Western Cape and Gauteng dumping money and in a sense not being honest, and maybe, you know, then they don't, you know, then maybe the treatment might not be the same in other provinces who are just giving an honest reflection of their underspending. And that was why I said I don't want to say that all underspending is unacceptable either, in a way, because if you can't spend according to plan and to perform as you said you would, please just don't go and dump the money. You know, in that sense, we'd rather actually identify it as, I don't think we try not to use the word savings anymore. We talk about expenditure cuts. We'd rather cut it and do something else with it. But yeah, it's a thorny issue, and it's something which we do battle with, I think, quite a bit. And the same thing with the rollovers. You know, I think we are being increasingly strict and intolerant of perpetual offenders, and we track that, and that is what we look at, whether this is the third time that this department wants to come tell us the same story. And I guess an example to use about the non-performance in terms of the savings, the savings in terms of non-performance. Sorry, I just want to get back there. You'll recall that when I spoke to that second bullet, I said the easy part was being able to find savings or make spending reductions where people are able to continue to produce what they said they're going to at a lower cost. The other two are more difficult,
when looking at programs performing below expected levels. An example which jumps straight into mind here is the education infrastructure grants. That money is so sorely needed, particularly in the province from which I hail. Truth of the matter, though, is that that money, in the last budget, in the last financial year, was not going to be spent, couldn't be spent, had to be reduced in terms of an expenditure reduction. And then even after that, there was underspending on that money. And yes, the plans, plans that we saw are there and so on, but actually, as you track month on month, you see that that's not going to happen. So it's not a happy state of affairs, but we can't leave the money lying there and pretend that it's going to be spent when we're paying interest costs on it. And then also, even decreasing outputs when it's a lower priority program, sometimes that's, in the beginning when we started doing these 3 years ago or so, that was maybe easier to pick up. But now, it's a lower priority program, but it's still something maybe that we would have liked if we could afford it. It's not completely a useless program. So those are quite difficult calls, but I guess these are quite difficult times. The key thing, I think, and this is probably sounding like a stuck record, is the performance linked to the expenditure. And you'd ask whether Treasury is soft or what the problem may be. But essentially, departments are not accountable to the Treasury in terms of their performance against their plans. So we publish in a budget what performance they have committed to relative to the budgets that they table. But they need to be held account to that. Sure, in the next budget process, we do that. Of course, we look at that and so on. But there needs to be, I think, some purposeful interventions in terms of the departments, which also require, I think, Parliament to become also extra vigilant, and Treasury, obviously, also to become extra vigilant. But I'm going to stop there and give Wendy a chance.
Just to add to the issue that was raised about the DBSA, I attended a session yesterday with the Portfolio Committee on Energy, where the Department of Energy actually indicated that currently what is happening is that municipalities are actually signing contracts with the DBSA, which then assists them to accelerate a lot of the electrification. So that fund's already being used in certain respects, the one of the municipalities. And the DBSA can play quite a nice role there because they've got the technical competency and engineering competencies that some of these smaller municipalities really, really lack. So that is one of the good developments that the DBSA is currently playing, is that they're extending their focus, not just to focus on the big municipalities like they did in the past, but also looking at the smaller municipalities where there's actually capacity constraints. Then with regard to the question about benchmarking municipal costs and actually what percentage of the budget it should make, keep in mind that we've currently got 278 municipalities where the metro budgets like exceeds 20 billion rand, and some of the smaller municipalities it's barely 100 million, for example. So also the services they need to provide is very, very different. If you look at the metropolitan municipalities, they serve big industries as well, where some of the smaller municipalities really don't really have a big customer base. And even in cases where there's also agencies such as water boards and Eskom that then alongside the municipalities also provide services. So it is actually very difficult to say what should the ratio be, because in a small municipality, a much higher ratio for personnel is actually acceptable than, for example, the metro. If you've got a metro where it's 50% of the overall budget, then you'll get very, very scared because that is definitely too high. But in certain smaller municipalities, that is an acceptable level. So that's why there's no standardized norms. It's also got to do with whether a municipality contracts out a service or provides a service directly, where it's important. So some of the issues, and we've done it in our last local government budgets and expenditure review, we did a bit of analysis on that. There's a whole personnel chapter that actually gives quite useful information. For example, what we picked up is some smaller municipalities pay higher salaries to their CFOs, for example, than a much larger municipality. So there's various things that actually drive those type of costs. Then with regard to what are we doing with regard to interventions and the like, and does National Treasury have teeth? Maybe what's important is to, and it's such a multi-pronged answer, but maybe the first answer that if it's a political problem, technical solutions won't help. And if it's a technical problem, political solutions won't help. So the challenges are so very, very different. But there's some good developments taking place. Again, it's not just National Treasury. There's also other sector departments that's involved. For example, if there's water quality issues, you would like to see the National Department of Water Affairs knocking on that municipal door and telling them, pick up your game, because lack of good water quality can actually result in health hazards, for example. So one of the good developments that's currently underway, the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs have actually picked up a gap, because currently you can just use Section 100 or Section 139 as interventions, but actually you need multiple sets of interventions. If, for example, if there's capacity challenges and you actually build capacity, hopefully you'll get past the problem. But if you've got a malicious non-compliance and you come in with a capacity building initiative, it will get you absolutely nowhere. So what that legislation is doing, it's still in development stage, but it will allow for a more holistic intervention approach. So that will be key legislation in actually getting more structured interventions from national government and provincial governments as well. Because keep in mind as well that when it comes to municipalities, first the province must intervene, and if the province neglects to intervene, then only national government can come into play. But for functions that's concurrently between national and local governments, such as water, sanitation, and electricity, they don't have the technical skills on provincial level to action, because they don't have any responsibilities in that regard. So some of these things are a bit complicated, but it's been dealt with in that legislation. So that's just one type of intervention. Then another intervention is what we're doing from National Treasury side, is strengthening our budget oversight over municipalities, both for those that we actually monitor directly and those that we're also focusing on building the capacity of provincial treasuries, because we just monitor 17 municipalities directly. And we're also doing what we call improved reporting in terms of standard accounting practices, so that we can in future be able to better compare apples with apples. And that will also result in regulations going forward as well. So there's various initiatives underway to actually strengthen our monitoring over municipalities. Then with regard to the underspending on a conditional grant and what happens, again, the answer is multi-pronged. It's not just one response. For example, if you look at the municipal infrastructure grants and also the urban settlements development grants, if you've underspent this year, will it impact on your next year's allocation? And the answer is actually no, because those allocations are formula driven, it's general allocations to the municipalities concerned. Then there's also reduced allocations, which is not necessarily bad. If you look at, for example, the INEP allocation or the Integrated Electrification Program grant, what happens is that specific projects are identified and those specific projects are then funded. So you will see the allocation shift amongst municipalities as they roll out those type of electrification programs. But then other grants, such as the transport grants that go to municipalities, they do look at expenditures application-based again, and allocations can actually be reduced. but it's not always reduced for bad reasons either. For example, if you look at the transport grants that go to local government, some of the allocations were deliberately reduced, but it's then given back in later years. And the reason why is that, for example, the BRT is very good for metropolitan municipalities, but what they then determined for secondary towns, that type of system is not cost effective in the secondary towns. So then the National Department of Transport had to go back to the drawing board and fix how they deal with those type of municipalities. So it means that the funds are taken away now, but given back at a later stage. So it doesn't, and then it's more appropriate projects are being funded in that regard. But a key issue that needs to be mentioned here, well, I can mention three things as well. When a municipality underspends, it's the National Transferring Officer that should actually have a monitoring system in place. So if electricity grants are underspent, you would like to see the Department of Energy actually doing the monitoring support role there as well. And the same applies to other grants in the system as well. But then if you look at some of the other initiatives underway, is that, again, with greater BLOM, the MISA has been introduced, or the Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency, that will evidently also fill a gap in the system. It's a new, let's hope that over time we see the evidence in that regard, but they've also got engineers online to assist municipalities and the like. And then a third initiative, Dr. Brown also refers to that, is that some national departments have given up to some extent on provinces and local government and has now introduced indirect grants. And currently, if you look at the performance of indirect grants, it's often worse than the performance by the province or the municipality concerned. If you look at the school backlog infrastructure grant, its current spending is about 33%, in the first year it was at 10%. If you look at the rural household infrastructure grant, another grant that's highly contested, that spending was also very, very low. And so the issue is some of the solutions to actually get the spending up. This is also critical in the process. So it is critical that we build the capacity and take corrective action when there's deliberate incorrect spending on the conditional grants. Because, for example, if you've got a municipal infrastructure grant money that's used for salaries, and you say the municipality can keep that money, you're sending such a wrong signal in the system. So it's better that that money be returned to the fiscus so that that accountability link is there. And what I could propose, possibly that could help as well, is because often when the committees actually does their monitoring, they look at the spending on conditional grants. But maybe what could be quite useful is there's maybe a broader session on local government support and local government intervention, and that Jan Hutting, that's responsible on the local government side, actually does a bit of a briefing to this committee to indicate what we do during the benchmarking exercises, how the INEAS system actually works, what do we actually monitor to actually determine whether a municipality is in financial distress or not. There's like 17 or 18 indicators that's put forward. And actually how we can actually then use the current information in the system and actually make it to the disposal of these committees so that they can also use it in the oversight role. So that's just a proposal. Because there's so many things that can be raised here, and it requires, it actually potentially require quite a long session. Thanks.
Madam, is there a question or comment?
Chairperson, no, I want to link up with the law centers. The FFC, before this committee regarding the interaction with municipalities on the local government fiscal issues. It will complement that if we call Mr. Hutter, because he's running the unit in Treasury that actually deals with this. And that will fill up the whole picture. example, I make use of Mr. Atten in my own constituency, Kamiesberg. It was on the brink of the Section 139 intervention. And through the assistance of National Treasury, we got going. But the reality is, and it's not only in Kamiesberg, the income is 500,000 a month, the expenditure per month is 2 million. Now put yourself in that position with your own finances. Where are you going to land up? And that is the issue we have to address. Me, Magarang, and so I can go on to the Northern Cape. Where is it leading to? And we will have to come up with a solution. And also engage with the demarcation board, and I think it was mentioned yesterday, to look at the bigger picture. Because at the end of the day, what legacy are we leaving in 2014 for the new members coming back here? They will have to deal with it. This will be there. It won't fly away. So I just want to bring that together. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much, honorable members and Mr. Ferrari, for the clarities. I hope it has covered all questions raised. And we'll continue interacting with all stakeholders on a number of these things. So, honourable members, back to the appropriation bill now. It would seem that we don't have any issues with the bill itself after the clarities. And I do have in front of me a short standard report that we usually adopt after interacting with this bill. And if you allow me, I'll read it for you. Just four lines. The report of the Select Committee on Appropriations on the Appropriation Bill B1 2013, National Assembly Section 77, dated 19 June 2013. That's the heading. The Select Committee on Appropriations, having considered the Appropriation Bill B1 2013, referred to it and classified by the Joint Taking Mechanism as a Section 77 bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill without amendment. That's the report. If we so agree, may I get the mover in the second? Honorable Mashile?
Chairperson, I want to move that we adopt the report.
Thank you, Honorable. Second, any objection? No objections. Thank you, honourable members. honourable Liz didn't hear you. Honourable members, we have adopted that, and I think we'll get the report through to the House tomorrow, so that we finish the business of this appropriation bill now that all the budget funds have been debated and completed. So that's the understanding we had earlier on. So honourable members, item number 2 on the agenda. Thank you very much for your contribution on the appropriation bill matters, and the last item on the agenda is the minutes of yesterday. During the course of this meeting, I received only one apology from Honorable Bloom.
Yeah.
Just for the record. Thank you. I'm still on page 1, honourable members. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to raise a naughty issue. is that I know that the Committees of Finance and Appropriations shares membership. But I just wanted to suggest that when we go down to the committee's support staff, we must start with the relevant staff for the committee. We must start with the relevant staff for the committee. I think it will just simply bring some sense, Chair. Thank you very much.
Can you repeat yourself? Sorry, I missed that one.
I'm saying, Chair, that when we, the staff that we attend the meetings, that when we write the committee staff, it's not necessarily on this specific one. I've seen on the other documents, just to ensure that the committee staff, we must start with those that are relevant to the committee.
Like this, Annie?
Yes.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Page 2, honorable members. If there's just a comment, honorable Joseph, don't worry. Page 2. Honourable Fakou, I know just for your benefit, yesterday you arrived, but by the time you arrived, it was already finance meeting.
Okay,
yeah. But what we agreed yesterday was that in future, if you could talk to your secretary, because secretaries have got tendencies of sending apologies to the emails of secretaries when secretaries are in a meeting, so that does not help. If the meeting is already on, they rather bring the apology here so that we can be able to record it as someone who has arrived late. I'm on page 2.
I move the adoption, Mr. Chair.
If there's nothing, can we get the move on that day machine?
Chairperson, I just wanted to applaud, just to applaud, Chair, that this time around, you see, we have got this paper printed on both sides. And I think we just need to applaud that, Chair, and on that note, and then I move for adoption of those motions.
You can't, I've already moved.
That is saving, Honorable Mashile Moose, and Honorable Joseph.
Doesn't matter, just put it in
there. Oh, Honorable Lee second. Thank you very much. Honorable members, that brings us to the end of today's meeting, and I wish to thank you.
Thank you to you, Mr. Chairman.
Now the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much.
Go to move. Come on, come on.